My name is Joe, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Joe.
It's good to be back this morning. John and I were saying we got a lot of strong-willed people here that made it back. I think that this is a fascinating part of this program, I think we have laid the groundwork last night. We'll review for a minute. And we say that last night we dealt with the first four chapters. In the study, we see that this is lays the groundwork and the foundation. And it's in these chapters that we have identified and understood the problem of alcoholism for the first time in our lives. And then it has told us about a solution to this problem. So at this point, we have gathered two facts, basically. And we know that these first four chapters, as the author said, related to the first two steps, and why this is not mentioned in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And one of the first things that we must do, and what this book helps us to do, is to gather these facts. And we arrive to the point which we say, which the great study shows, that is the first step of recovery, is the point of decision. And I think that we can see the great design that is laid out in the big book. If I might back up for a minute, I noticed the blackboard up here, and I usually like sometimes, I don't spell too well and don't draw too well, but sometimes, you know, it can, a little design or a doodle might help you a little bit. I think that the first step over here indicates a fact, one fact. And it says in this fact, the first step, we found out that this was our problem. And the problem encompasses two ideas. One idea, that we have an allergy of the body and an obsession of the mind. And that it says that these encompass two problems. Because I have an allergy of my body, and my body does not metabolize like other people, I cannot drink alcohol safely. That's one of my problems. I can't drink alcohol. I could. If I had an allergy to strawberries, I could eat strawberries, but I could not eat them safely. And he says also that I have an obsession of my mind. And because this obsession of the mind, I cannot quit drinking. And if I have an allergy to the body, which I cannot drink safely, an obsession of the mind, which I cannot quit drinking, then I am powerless over alcohol. And that shows me my problem for the first time in my life. Now the second step, after showing me the problem and able to understand it, we often say that people don't accept the first step. And I really think that really acceptance comes through understanding. Understanding. And maybe we don't accept the first step because we really don't understand it, because we haven't studied the foundation of the book. Now, the second step, after it really identifies and helps us understand the problem, the second step speaks of simply a possible solution. This is another fact which it gives us. And it talks about a possible way out, and it begins to explain the solution to fellowship, and then it begins to explain in the second chapter the solution of the spiritual experience. And in this thing, it lays out a solution. And this is what is done, and then we evaluate ourselves in the spiritual relations in chapter 4. And then we enter chapter 5, which is the first progressive step of the program is listed in how it works, how to bring about this solution, and it's listed in a step down here, which is basically, we'll write these things out here, we'll leave problem over here, because if you have a problem and you have a solution, then the next step of recovery, and I think our first progressive step, is to make a decision. And we learn that the word decision, as we begin here on page 60, encompasses an idea, and these words spell out specific things. We must get into the words to find out what this problem is all about. And we learned that the word decision means to dissect. It comes from the Greek word dissect, which means to cut in two. And then we see the great design of the problem was to give us two facts, and then it says the process of cutting them in two is decisions. I think my book speaks of this as we stood at the turning point. Now, uniquely think of this little critical area here, where we turn away from what we know is bad to what we believe is better. And as this is the critical part that we're going to arrive to since laying this groundwork, we're going to start here with a progressive step. The first step of progress, after gathering two facts, we are able to make a decision. Now, at this point in the book, he begins not to only to, he begins to give us a design of the alcoholic personality. And he begins to tell us why. He will just tell us why we should do this before we are asked to do it. And so it's very explained, very in great study. It will reveal that he begins to paint a picture of the alcoholic. He begins here to talk about self. And he says that selfishness is self-centered. And he begins to talk about this particular characteristic of the alcoholic. And he begins to talk about this strong will. And we talked about this self-directed person. And this is the root of our problems. And it's at this point that he begins to draw a design of what is our main problem. And he says the heart of the alcoholic's problem is self. Right here on page 60, as we get to step three, and this is where step three begins. This is the first step that's mentioned in the book, and it's written out, and we'll notice in the little script writing, it says step three. He begins to describe what this self person does. He's the guy that makes all the arrangements. He runs the show. We have a little more of this than most people. This inner drive. It's a great quality in an individual, and we don't have it by chance. It is God-given. God gave us self-will. And I think he describes the alcoholic as an individual that has a little more of this than most people. And he says selfish and self-centered is what we think is the root of our troubles, the center of our personality problems. Driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity, we step on the toes of our fellows and they retaliate. Then he goes down, he says, so our troubles, we think, are basically out of our own making. They arise out of ourselves, and the alcoholic is an extreme example of a self-will run riot, though he usually doesn't think so. Above everything, we alcoholics must be rid of selfishness. We must, or it will kill us, and he says God makes that possible. And here we begin to learn this great self-factor, and I learned in the great later on in this program in the fourth step, as I was able to look back in my life, I found out I had a lot of this way before I ever discovered alcohol. I always was a self-driven person. I had a lot of goal. I had a little more of this than most people, and I use this as a success mechanism in my life. And I use it to accomplish things. In fact, this is about the only thing I did use. And every time I used it, it got bigger. And I told myself, see, you can do anything if you try hard enough. And the same thing that got me sick is the same thing like to kill me, because that's the same thing I was trying to use to get sober. Self. And he paints a very beautiful picture of this self factor. And he says they rise out of ourselves. And he says, there seems no way of ridding oneself of self, and God makes this possible. And remember, we talked last night about this great step. And this was a great step. This was the idea. The idea of this step was not given to us by a theologian, or was it created by Bill, or Dr. Bob, or even Dr. Silkworth, Dr. Hume, the psychiatrist. He was the one that told, as Silkworth and Bill stared at this problem, this lock that they had discovered. We know God in his grace. And Dr. Jung told Roland H. And Dr. Roland H. came back and told Ebby. And Ebby brought this key to Bill and Dr. Silkworth. So this was a great idea. That through a vital spiritual experience, the self factor can be removed from the alcoholic's life. And then certain adjustments can be made in steps 4, 5, 6, and 7. But until this self factor is tempered, and the only known way this has ever been done in the personality of an alcoholic is very simple, as explained in this step. Because it says he makes this decision to turn his will. That is the key to the word that gives a lot of people a lot of problems. Now we learned that the word will is very simple, and Charlie read the old version of the book in which they made some changes before it was printed, and we think maybe sometime they would have left some of these things that have been plainer. But we like to explain it as will. Will is a little word that we all know what it means and know how to use it. But do we really know the nitty-gritty idea of the word will? I like to play the game of when a person dies, he writes a will. The family carries him out to the graveyard. He's not there. And they rush back home fast as they can to get out this little piece of paper. And on this little piece of paper is the person is not there, so he's left, even we might say, a certain set of directions that he wants carried out. He says, give my wife so much, give my son so much. And he wants these directions carried out. So a will is simply a set of directions. And it means the same here in our program. We are self-directed people. And the only way that a self-directed person can get out of that position is turn his life over to a director. And then he loses his job. You know, it's simple. You know, the guy that runs the corporation, as they say, he's an employer. You know, he's got all the problems. He's got the payroll. He's got the internal revenue to fool with. He's got all these problems as the corporate executive. But you know how simple it would be for him to turn this corporation over to somebody else and he just draws off the stock and the dividends. He don't have to be the director anymore. And so this is the example that is so plain. This is the only way a director can get out of that position is turn his life over to another director or turn his directions over to God. And then later on in this program, we'll get down to it pretty soon. We're going to find that we have another step that we have to talk to that co-mingles with this step. Because once the person turns over his directions in step 3, in step 11, through prayer and meditation, he's able to receive directions. And these two steps will relate together. But in step 3, we'll get rid of the basic thing. And we know that the self-directed people, and we're talking about nothing dirty in an individual's life. I like to look at these things in not a negative way. I think our book describes that all these things are part of a personality and they are a great necessity. Even resentments. Fear is great and resentment is good. All of these things are not dirty. They are a constructive part of a person's personality. But because of a self factor, the strong self drive, we become overdeveloped in certain areas of our lives. You know, resentment is good and aggressiveness is good and fear protects us. And sex makes us redevelop, as the 12 and 12 say. All these things are great qualities in our life. But as we look at nature, we can see that the same things take place in nature, the great necessities of life, like the water and heat and things we need to heat our homes. Every once in a while we get too much in one place and we got a catastrophe. And the same things happen within our personalities. Because of the self-drive, the very necessities of life become damaging to us. And quite naturally, you know, when we take a drink, we can take a drink of alcohol at a different time. And we can depress these things in our lives, and this is what we've been doing for quite a few years. So now we get into the nitty-gritty of the problem itself, and there is no other known way to remove this from the alcoholic personality. So this is a spiritual tool that is in the spiritual foundation, and this is the first thing necessary to recover from alcoholism, is to remove the self factor. And after giving this to us, later on down, he tells us a lot about this. He says, most good ideas are simple. And this concept was the keystone of the new and triumphant arch through which we pass to freedom. Now, we really have to do a little going back here to get the idea of what he's speaking of there. We go back into somewhere in high school or somewhere in junior high school, somewhere we were exposed to some Greek architect. And we learn about the arch. And we know that this arch, these arches used to be constructed out of stone. And these stones were designed to lay in place. And at the top, there was a stone at the top in which all the other stones leaned against.
the way of these stones leans against this stone in the middle.
And this was a supporting stone of the arch. And this stone was called the keystone. Because once it was removed, the whole thing would cave in. So this is the design that he's using here. Step three, which removes self, is the foundation in recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous, in this program. And this is the only known way that this has ever been done. So we're not asked to make this decision based on what we want to do. We get two ideas, and with honesty, we cut them in half. And we make a decision, and this lays the keystone in place. And we ride at really our first step of recovery, because it is the first step in which we have done something about the problem after the two great fat gaps. So,
when I look at step three, where we made a decision to turn our will and our life over to the care and direction of God, I always like to go back once again and see, really, why is it necessary that we have to do this? And in going back and looking to see why we have to do this, I have to go back again to Dr. Silkworth's opinion. When Dr. Silkworth tells us that whenever we're sober, we're restless and we're irritable and we're discontented. And you know, last night we said we could add some more words onto that. We're full of shame and guilt and fear and remorse and anger and resentment and jealousy and so on and so forth. And Silkworth says when we're sober, we're restless and irritable and discontented until we can again experience the ease and comfort which comes at once by taking a few drinks. Drinks which we see others taking with impunity. And after we succumb to the desire again, as so many do, we pass through the well-known stages of a spree, emerging remorseful with a firm resolution not to drink again. And he says we do this over and over and over and over unless we can experience an entire psychic change. And as he talks about the psychic change, he's talking about the mind. That's it. That when we say psychic, we were talking about matters of the mind itself. And when I really look at myself honestly in the light of Dr. Silkworth's opinion, and also I'm told this in the big book, that my problem really centers in my mind rather than in my body. The big book tells me that if I didn't take the first drink, then this drunken spree and all these troubles and all these things wouldn't occur. And this is true. The allergy that I have to alcohol does not hurt me at all unless I take the first drink. And if I take the first drink and the phenomenon of craving develops, then I'm drunk and then I'm sick and then I'm in trouble. So according to what Silkworth says, if I want to stay sober, if I want to live without taking that first drink which triggers the allergy off, it's going to be necessary for me to find a way to live to where I'm not restless and I'm not irritable and I'm not discontented whenever I'm sober. And we're dealing with the mind. Now the thing that keeps me from being happy when I'm sober is the fact that I'm always wanting more than I should have. And the big book tells me that selfishness and self-centeredness, that's my problem, that I run on my own will. And again, as an intellectual alcoholic, I had to go find out what will is. And Joe gave one description of will. Will being something or a set of directions that we write and leave behind us whenever we die. But another example of my self-will. You know, we have today, throughout the United States, a speed limit of 55 miles per hour. Now, if I'm out here on one of these good freeways, and I'm cruising along at 55 miles an hour or less, I'm running on the state's will. And as long as I'm running on the state's will, I'm tooling down that highway, and I'm just going along fat, dumb, and happy, and I'm not worrying about anything at all. But my will begins to tell me that this is too slow. that I need to get there a little bit faster. You know, I'm in a hurry. I'm an impatient individual. I'm used to doing things the way I want to do them and doing them in a hurry. So I decide I'll drive 65 miles an hour or 70 or 75 or 80. Now, almost instantaneously, whenever I start exceeding the speed limit, I immediately have to start thinking about some things. I've got to start thinking about, I wonder where the highway patrol is. Is he going to be behind this next culvert that I go by up here? Is he going to be back behind me, sneaking up on me, coming in from the back? Or is he in this spotter airplane that's flying up and down the freeways all the time? And I immediately begin to experience fear.
Now, I was riding along at 55, fat, dumb, and happy, and I wasn't having any problems at all, and I had peace of mind. But immediately, whenever I began to operate on my will, I began to experience a loss of peace of mind. And as I've heard Joe say before, and I love it so well, you can go out to a shopping center and you can watch the people as they walk up and down the sidewalks, and most of those people settle down to a normal rate of speed. They've learned that if they don't go with the flow, it's going to create some problems, and they'll all be walking along about the same rate of speed. Nobody's bumping into anybody. Nobody's hurting anybody. Nobody's making anybody mad. But you see an alcoholic come down through this sidewalk, and he's in a hurry. You know, and he shoves people to the side, and he bumps people, and he moves them on, and he gets on, and he stomps on them, and he steps on them, and he's operating on self-will. He's going against the will of the crowd. And if he does that, if he does it so long and so much, and he does it to the wrong person, he's going to hit another self-will person. And they're going to turn around and they're going to bust him in the mouth. I think we need to bear in mind that for the doctor's opinion and the first four chapters of the big book, we were dealing a whole lot with alcohol. We talked about alcohol. We talked about it in the chapter, There Is a Solution. We talked about it in There Is More About Alcoholism. We talked about alcohol in Bill's story. We talked about alcohol in Dr. Silkworth's opinion. Now we've reached a point in the big book where we don't talk about alcohol anymore. From this point on, we're talking about the mind. We're talking about what is necessary to take the psychic chains that Dr. Silkworth discussed. We're talking about what is necessary to have the vital spiritual experience. You know, even Dr. Jung's description of the vital spiritual experience, he says, suddenly the old ideas and the old concepts and the old motives, which were the guiding factors of this man's life, were suddenly cast aside, and they were replaced with new ideas and new concepts and new motives. Dr. Jung was talking about the mind. And I think when we look at step three, there's three words that we really ought to take a real close look at. To begin with, step three says we made a decision. Okay, if we've studied the big book, and if we've read the doctor's opinion, and if we've read the first four chapters, and if we agree with those, then we have made, really, two decisions before we ever get to the third step. Number one, we've admitted we were powerless over alcohol and that our lives are unmanageable. No way we can drink this alcohol. No way that we can stay sober by ourselves. We've looked at step two and we have come to believe that there is a power greater than ourselves that can restore us to sanity. And I think for many of us in the beginning, that power that's greater than ourselves has to be the AA group. You know, when I came in here, I was so agnostic. I had an aversion to anything spiritual, to anything that smacked of religion, to anything that smacked of prayer, and I simply could not conceive of me ever trying to develop a spiritual life. But I looked around at the people in AA and I heard them talk, and I saw some of these old gray-headed guys that'd get up behind the podium and they'd say, by the grace of God and the help of the AA program, I haven't found it necessary to take a drink for X number of years, 5, 10, 8, 15, 20, 25 years. And I could look at these people and I could see that they were happy, and they had something that I wanted. And in one respect, they were a power greater than I was. They had what I wanted, and I was going to try to get it. And for a long time, I had to make the AA group and the AA people the power greater than myself. And I believe that's why step two doesn't talk about God. I believe that's why it talks about a power greater than ourselves to enable us to get over the hurdle of this God thing. And as I looked at step two and it says that this power greater than ourselves, I begin to believe that it could restore me to sanity. And as we looked at the chapter last night to more about alcoholism, and we talked about the story of Jim and Fred, and we talked about the story of the jaywalker, it became quite evident that we must have some form of insanity or we wouldn't go back to drinking that booze from time to time. Now, when I have come to those two conclusions, when I've been able to admit that I'm powerless over alcohol and my life is unmanageable, when I'm able to agree that there is a power greater than myself that can restore me to sanity, then I'm ready to make a decision. Now, the decision can go one of three ways. You know, it's quite easy for me to come into AA and say, yes, I'm powerless over alcohol and my life is unmanageable. Yes, I believe there is a power greater than myself that can restore me to sanity. My decision could go that I don't want that power to restore me to sanity, that I would prefer to do this thing my way. And many of us make that decision. And I made that decision for the first year and a half in AA. I felt that there had to be a way that Charlie could do this thing the way Charlie wanted to do it. That there had to be a way that I could work the program the way I wanted to work it. And I made a decision that, oh, sure, I'm powerless over alcohol and my life's unmanageable. Oh, yes, I believe there's a power greater than myself can restore me to sanity, but my decision was that I don't want nothing to do with that power, that I'm going to work this program any way I want to, and I'm going to stay sober by myself. Now, if I make that decision, chances are I'm going to go back out and drink some more. That's exactly what happened to me. Another way this decision could go, a person can say, well, certainly I'm powerless over alcohol and my life is unmanageable. He can say, certainly I believe there is a power greater than myself that can restore me to sanity, but I don't want to be restored to sanity, I want to drink. And we see this in AA all the time. And if a person makes this decision, chances are he's going to go back out here and drink some more. The third way this thing can go is that, yes, I'm powerless over alcohol. Yes, my life is unmanageable. Certainly I believe there is a power greater than myself that can restore me to sanity, that can remove this crazy, insane obsession of the mind that causes me to drink now and then when I shouldn't be doing it. And the decision could be, I believe I'll turn it over to that power. And we have a guy from Tahlequah, Oklahoma, that puts it just about as simple as I ever heard it. He says, step one is, I can't. And step two is that he can. And step three is that I believe I'll let him do it. We make the decision that we're going to let God or the higher power or whatever we want to call him take away this crazy, insane obsession of the mind. We're going to let God do our thinking. We're going to let God be the director of our thinking because, you see, my thinking is the thing that always causes me to go back and take the first drink. Now, the word decision itself. Whenever we make a decision, that does not necessarily mean that we have done anything at all. And the example that I like to use is I sit here at this table now, and let's say that I make a conscious decision that I've got to get up and go back here to the bathroom and pee. If I sit here and I decide that I need to go back to the bathroom and pee, unless I take some action, I will be sitting here an hour from now or 2 hours from now making the decision that I need to go back to the bathroom to pee. In order for me to get the job done, I'm going to have to get off my duff and I'm going to have to take some action to implement and carry out the decision that I've made. And I hear people in AA today talk and they say, oh, here I've been in AA for 3 or 4 years, and I'm not happy, and my life's all screwed up, and I can't understand what the trouble is because I turned my life and my will over to the care of God as I understand him in step three. And my answer is bullcrap. In step three, we make a decision, period. We decide that we're going to do this. Now, what is it we're going to turn over to him? After we make the decision, what is it we're going to turn over to him? The step three talks about will and life. Will is nothing more than thinking. Whatever my mind thinks, this is what I'm eventually going to do. If my mind thinks long enough about drinking, eventually I'll drink. If my mind thinks long enough about stealing, eventually I'll steal. If my mind thinks long enough about lying, eventually I'll lie. If my mind thinks long enough about adultery, eventually I will commit adultery. Now, my problem is that my thinking all my life has caused me to do things that I should not do. It's caused me to do things which has thrown me in conflict with other people. And as I'm thrown in conflict with other people, these people retaliate. And as they retaliate, it causes suffering and pain and humiliation for me. My thinking is the thing that got me to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I know in the beginning I looked at step three and I said, I'm kind of afraid to turn this thing over to the care of God as I understand him, because in the first place I don't understand him, and I really don't know what will happen if I turn it over to him. He might want me to go to the deepest, dark regions of South Africa and be a missionary or something. I'm afraid to turn it over to him. And an old-timer in AA reared back and looked at me, and he grinned, and he said, "Charlie, did you ever think about this? That at least if you turn your thinking over to the care of God as you understand him, it will not be in the hands of an idiot." And the only thing that I've got to do today is stop and think. If my thinking apparatus, which is my mind, if it was so good, if I had so much intellect, if I was so intelligent, how did my life get so screwed up that I had to come to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous? My thinking is what got me here. Now, my daddy used to tell me when I was a kid, and I didn't understand what he said. My daddy always said, "Charlie, you will always be what you think." He says, "If you think good, you'll be good." He says, "If you think bad, you'll be bad." He said, "If you run with the dogs, you'll be a dog. And if you run with good people, you'll be a good person." And I didn't tie that together until I'd been in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous for a long time. My will is my thinking. My life is my actions. My life today is made up of a series of actions that I take. My whole life has been made up of all the series of actions that I've taken from the day I was born. If my thinking is good, my actions which make up my life will automatically follow to be good. If my thinking is bad or wrong, then my actions which make up my life will automatically be bad or wrong. Now, my thinking is what caused me to take all the actions that I've taken all my life that got me to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. It is time for me to let something else direct my thinking. If I can let something else direct my thinking, then my life will automatically be good if that director is the right person. And the person who I'm asking in step three to direct my thinking for me is God as I understand it. And if I can receive the directions from God to control my thinking, then my life, my actions will automatically become good. If I don't receive that and keep running on my own will, my own self-will, I am continually going to be in conflict with other people. And you know, many, many times I do things and used to do things that I knew they were the wrong thing to do. I would go ahead and do them, and immediately when I did them, I had to start worrying about what's other people going to do and think and say whenever they find out about it. And whenever they did find out about it, they were going to retaliate against me and cause further suffering and pain and humiliation to me. And I think those are the three key words that we need to look at when we look at step three. What is the decision? What is our will? And what is our life? And I think we need to be aware that in step three, all we're doing is making a decision. We make an effort, and we make this effort through a simple little prayer contained in the big book, and I think we need to look at this prayer. I think this prayer is one of the most important things in the big book, period, and it's on page 63. My big book tells me that if I have become convinced that my selfishness and self-centeredness is my problem, and if I have become convinced that I want to turn this thing over to a power greater than myself, that if I'm through fighting it, and I want the help from this power greater than me, we take a look at the middle paragraph on page 63, and it says, we were now at step three. It says, many of us said to our Maker as we understood him, God, I offer myself to thee to build with me and do with me as thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. May I do thy will always. We thought well before taking this step, making sure we were ready that we could at last abandon ourselves utterly to him. We make an effort in step three to turn it over. We make a decision, and we follow it with a prayer. And here we're ready now to let God start removing or start directing our thinking in order to have the peace of mind that Dr. Silkworth tells me that I must have if I want to stay sober.
We don't expect a whole lot after this. It's kind of a subtle thing that takes place, and I think it's mentioned right here at the bottom of that. He says, this was only a beginning. Though if honestly and humbly made, the effect sometimes, a very great one was felt at once. It's just a small beginning. And that 1, 2, and 3, our spiritual foundation is laid in place, and this is what I usually look at as the first three steps. 1, 2, and 3, the spiritual foundation is laid as results of 1, 2, and 3. And it removes the self factor uniquely. We take out self directions and we put in good, orderly directions. We switch. And we get rid of the heart of our problems. Charlie said, when a guy runs on self, he runs into other people. He's resentment prone. Comes out of self. The guy runs on self, he's fear prone. Fear comes from self. It mentions self-pity, which is self-resentment. It mentions also, our book deals with sex. And self-centered people overdevelop in their area of their self-worth. Their ego goes up sometimes. All these are overdevelopments of natural, healthy characteristics of people. And quite naturally, when they overdevelop, they underdevelop. They have certain shortcomings. Self-centered people, they got some little nails over on this side. They're a little short of love. They're real short of patience. And it's short of tolerance. Quite naturally, you know, as our book will describe in these next four steps, when we go to work on the things, once the self factor is removed, then our first step to recovery is to look at these areas. We cannot see these areas when the self factor is packed. But once the self factor is placed by God's directions, then we can see. And you know, the same guy is resentful as hell. He takes a drink, alcohol is a depressive drug, and he pushes it down. And the same resentful guy has all got all kind of love, tolerance, and patience. And the same guy has got a lot of fear. He can take a little drink over here and push this down, and man, he's got all kind of courage. He grows over here. So this is a game that we play most of our lives, and we talk about getting well. And the first thing is to really change this whole system, remove self. And once it's removed, we're ready to go to work. We're ready to go on the things that are blocking our growth. And so we're going to go into another phase of steps where we work on the things that grow out of self. 4, 5, 6, and 7. We've gotten right with God. Now we're going to get right with ourselves. And once God is intact, then we can go work on this other area of getting rid of the things that grow out of self. And the first step is in getting over any problem, as we say it, is to see the problem and to understand it. This is what we had to do with our original and step one. And the first step of getting rid of these problems that grow out of step, out of here, we have a step four, which is an identifying step, another identifying step. Now we will find that we have three identifying steps here. The first step where we done our overall problem, and after the self factor removed, we are able to take step four. We are able, once the God, the first opportunity we have, the first thing that God gives us is an opportunity to see. And we're able to take a searching and fearless moral inventory, which begins right at the next line that he begins to go into step four. He says, as Charlie says, if you have made the decision, a decision to be successful has to be followed by a course of action to carry out this decision. And once we have made this decision, it says next, we launched on a vigorous course of action. Charlie, which is that? The first step, which was a personal house cleaning. Step four. Which many of us has never attempted. And then he gets kind of tricky. He said, though our decision was a vital and critical step. Go back to three. That's step three. It could have little permanent effect unless once followed by a strenuous effort to face and get rid of the things in ourselves which was blocking us. Our liquor was but a symptom. We had to get down to the causes and conditions. Therefore, we started upon a personal inventory.
I think here we find another warning in the big book. It tells me at the top of page 64, though our decision, which we made in step 3, was a vital and crucial step, it could have little permanent effect unless at once followed by a strenuous effort to face and be rid of the things in ourselves which had been blocking us. Our liquor was but a symptom, so we had to get down to causes and conditions. And what they're really saying to me here is that, Charlie, you ain't going to be able to stay sober on step 1, 2, and 3. It says that step 3 is a vital step, and it's a crucial step, and I'm not going to do any good unless I take step 3, but that alone is not enough. I'm going to have to do certain things to carry out that decision that I made in step 3. And there's certain things that I'm going to have to do is first find out what is within me that blocks me from carrying out the decision that I've made in step 3. And I do this by making a searching and fearless moral inventory of myself to see what will block me from doing God's will. And you know, this is always the purpose of an inventory. Well, if I owned a store out here, and I found that my shelves were getting too full of goods, and I didn't have room to store anything else anymore, I'm going to have to go into that store, and I'm going to have to find out, what do I have in here that needs to be removed? And I take a searching and fearless inventory of that store, and I'm looking for unsaleable goods. I'm looking for things that haven't been moving fast enough. I'm looking for things that I'm going to have to get rid of. And this is exactly what I'm doing in step 4. I'm looking for the things that need to be removed from me, which will keep me from carrying out the decision that I made in step 3.
I think the key thing is locked up in the words, and really, we'll go back to the word inventory. And in great study in the dictionary, we'll find that every explanation of inventory will relate to a written list of items. There is no other kind of inventory other than a written one. I know we talk about one of these of the mind, but that would not be an inventory. An inventory is a written list of items. And we are to make, once we have the self-fact intact where we can see, we have the ability to take a written list of what is right and what is wrong. And at this point, it's simply we identify the things within us that are blocking our growth. The overdevelopments and the underdevelopments in our personality. And we finally find we get down to the cause and condition. I think that he listed this, he tells the word inventory specifically, and he'll later on, he'll go back and refer to it. We made this list later on down in step 8. Now, he says the resentment is the number one offender. It destroys more alcoholics than anything else. He begins to go into resentment, and we know this is a basic it's an instinct of people. It makes us aggressive. It makes us, it's a great instinct, and these things have great value. This makes man is a competitive creature, and it's basically our competitive nature that comes from this one factor. And this is a great part of a person's personality, and he needs it, and it's a great necessity. We're not talking about getting rid of, I think, resentment. We're talking about bringing them into context. And I think there's a lot of times we want to get rid of something that is natural within a personality, and if a person got rid of this, it would be totally impossible, and he would be less than a person. As we say, these things have become overdeveloped by the self factor. And we know that resentment comes from the, is a part of our personality. And this word comes from the word, sentry, which means to feel, and re, which means back, which is a process of refeeling things over again. When someone does something to you, they hurt you, yeah. And that's a wrong. And then you go home and replay it. So, you know, you play the whole scene over to get the feeling out to hurt yourself again. That is a resentment. And I like to look at resentments like the football games. Some of you will probably watch this evening, and a man will go down the field and he'll get hit. And it'll be pretty bad. It'll be a hurt. And they'll turn that darn resentment machine on. They got a videotape player. And they'll replay that scene. And as they replay it, in great reality, in slow motion, you can see the hurt, you can see his arms go up, and you can see the pain in his face. It was a lot worse than the first time you saw it. And the more they play it, the worse it gets.
And so we as alcoholics, we have videotape in living color. And we turn it on the world every day. And people do wrong us, but we come home and replay it and hurt ourselves. And I think that once we learn how stupid this is, you know, and we have always all our lives laid this on other people. But this book says resentment is our number one problem. And there are two types of resentment. One is a resentment against others. And then this great emotion is usually tied in with another emotion that we have. Once we are hurt by others, we always take the attitude that if this hadn't been here, this would have happened to me. The whole world is picking on me. And then we have a thing where we resent our position in life, which is self-pity. And so he says this is our number one problem. And I think that really the majority of alcoholics, and I know in my case, that really my number one problem was self-pity, self-resentment. I had more self-resentments than I did resentments to others. This is one thing that really made me uncomfortable. And I could go around as a great friend of mine all the time and says, pour me, pour me, pour me a drink. You know, this is the way I operate. And resentment was my number one problem. Refilling old hurts to hurt myself. The replaying, the playing back. And this is a problem of a self-centered person. We can see how this problem would develop in a person that would be self-centered. We could still go back to the root of our problem. As he goes through this, he goes into although he does say resentment is the number one problem, I'm really used to study why he didn't list them all, 2, 3, 4, 5. But I think maybe, you know, he left this so that we could all fit in. It wouldn't be no rigid situation where we could all come in. So he doesn't use this thing but one, and he doesn't use two. But later on, over on page 67, at the bottom of the page, he gets into our next greatest problem that comes out of self. After he talks about resentments, and we relate to self-pity, but both of these are resentments. Notice the word fear, which is bracketed along the difficulties of Mr. Brown. He begins to talk about fear. This evening in Corning 3, the fabric of our existence was shot through with it. And I mean, we know that fear is a great natural instinct, and because of self, as Charlie said, you know, when you're traveling on the state's will, you don't have any problem. But fear begins to go when self takes over, you begin to have fear. And people that are selfish, self-centered, they begin to anticipate life. They are the directors. And if you're the director, you're running the show, you have to anticipate things. So this fear begins to develop in our lives. And this is one of the next problems that causes us. And this directly comes from self. And he talks about this. And we go into this fear in great deal. And he tells us how to handle it. And we learn that this is a natural process. And I look at my fear. And I used to say if I could just get rid of it. And I hear so many people talking about eliminating fear from my life. But I really need fear. I need fear to cross the street. I need fear to run hot water in the sink. I need fear to take a shower. I need fear to do so many, many things all day. I wouldn't last the night if fear was taken from my life. Fear is a part of my life. And of course, quite naturally, as a child, I lived in a world, and I think that this is one of the great things. I live in a world of ignorance about our lives, and I was taught ignorance. No, they told me when I got 6 years old, you're a big boy now, you shouldn't have fear. And I felt guilty because I had it, you know. But this program told me that I do have fear, and that fear is healthy, and that I need it. But I had it in the wrong context in my life. And we know that fear, it plays a great part in people's lives, and it causes a lot of people destruction. And I learned, as Charlie said, that my thinking has to be correct. And I know that I cannot too, but one thing with my mind, I cannot think and have fear at the same time. But once my thinking is in control, then you know, fear is minimized in my life. It comes from self. So there's no way that I can have a fear with God. And I think that we hear this in all the work. Fear is a product of self. I can always say, what are they going to do to me? And it's a position of fear. But there's no way I can say, what are they going to do to me and God, God and I, and ever be in a position of fear? Because I'm in a different position with God directing my life. But I know that it's once this thing away that I am able to analyze my fears in this thing. And so fear is the number one instinct that he talks about. And then he gets down into childish favorite after he tells us about the overdevelopments of fear and the overdevelopments of resentment and self-pity. Then he tells us about sex.
We have in here, basically, they give us three areas
that we need to be inventoried. He told us first we needed to make a list of resentments, the people, places, institutions with whom or which we were angry. And he even went so far as to give us an example of how to make this list. He told us that we take the name of the person we're resentful toward, and we put him down on a piece of paper, and then over at the side of it, we put down why we're angry or resentful at them. And it told us then to try to determine which basic instinct caused that, which we'll talk about a little more just in a minute. After we made this list of resentments, these resentments are robbing me of peace of mind. That's why I need to look at them, because without the peace of mind, I'll look for the sense of ease and comfort which comes with taking a few drinks. He tells us that we reviewed our fears thoroughly, and we put these down on paper, and we write these fears down. And we put it down there why we have them, trying to decide, you know, what is it that's robbing us of peace of mind. And then we have a section in the big book on the bottom of page 68 that says, now about sex. It says many of us needed an overhauling there, but above all, we tried to be sensible on this question. It's so easy to get off the track. And once again, he's given us three areas that we need to be looking at. We need to be looking at resentments, we need to be looking at fears, and we need to be looking at sex. It says we reviewed our, on page 69, it says we reviewed our own conduct over the past years. Where had we been selfish, dishonest, or inconsiderate? Whom had we hurt? Did we unjustifiably arouse jealousy, suspicion, or bitterness? Where were we at fault? What should we have done instead? We got all this down on paper and looked at it. In this way, we tried to shape a sane and sound ideal for our future sex life. So we in AA, when we talk about sex, you know, we tend to think that this is a dirty thing. But it's not a dirty thing. Sex is a great thing. It's one of the most wonderful things that can happen to the human race. It's very enjoyable if we're doing it in the right places, in the right way, and with the right people. Remember, Joe said last night that this book was primarily authored by an intellectual Yankee. And this intellectual Yankee sometimes was quite hard to understand. And this section of the big book where we're dealing with resentments and fears and our wrongs that we've done to people in our lifetime and our sex life is a pretty confusing thing. It's very, very difficult to understand this. I've always been grateful that the book was written in 1939. But 13 years later, Bill Wilson, who had worked with literally thousands of alcoholics during that 13-year period, who knew a whole lot more about human nature, who knew a whole lot more at that time about what makes us tick, decided that we needed a better explanation for these steps. And he wrote another book in 1952, and they called it The 12 and 12. And in the 12 and 12, in chapter 4, in step 4, excuse me, dealing with the inventory, it starts out in the very beginning talking about the three basic instincts of life. Mm-hmm. It talks about the fact that all human beings are born first with a basic instinct for security, to see that we have enough in the future, to build the shelter that we need from the elements, to gather up the food and things that we're going to have in order to be sure and have enough to eat tomorrow and next week and next winter and etc. And he says that all human beings are born with this basic instinct. That without this basic instinct for security, that the human race could not survive, and we couldn't. We'd freeze to death and we'd starve to death, and eventually the human race would die out if we didn't do something to ensure some security in the future. He says also that all human beings are born with a basic instinct for sex. And says without the basic instinct for sex, there would be no reproduction of human beings and the human race would not survive. We would all eventually die out. And he says we're also born with a basic instinct for our place in society. He says that all people want to be liked and respected by other people. That all people like to want to join together, and I think that maybe the psychiatric profession would refer to this as the herd instinct. I don't know. It really doesn't make any difference. But I do know that we're all concerned with what other people think of us. Because if we went off on our own, and every human being went his own way, it would be dog-eat-dog and complete anarchy, and there would be no survival of the human race. And he goes into great detail in the 12 and 12 to explain to us that these three basic instincts are God-given things, and that they are necessary for survival of the human race, and they're not necessarily a bad thing. Where they become a bad thing is at the point at which we depart again from the normal. Now, if I have an overabundance of the desire for security, and I'm literally scared to death that I'm not going to have enough to eat in the future, or I'm not going to have shelter, or I'm not going to have what I need for me and my family to survive, then I'm going to start doing some things which are really probably the wrong thing to do. I'm probably going to work 12, 14, 16, 18 hours a day and accumulate that money so I'll be sure I got enough in the future. And the more money I get, the more of it, the more trouble I have, because I become terribly afraid that something's going to happen, that I'm going to lose this money and I'm not going to be secure in the future. And chances are I'm not smart enough to really make $1 million, so I'll have to do a little lying and cheating and conning and manipulating and stealing in order to gather up all these material things that I think that I need for the future. And if I'm doing some lying and cheating and conning and manipulating and stealing and working 12 and 14 and 16 and 18 hours a day, and I'm getting this money and I'm accumulating it and I'm putting it in the bank, and my wife's wanting a new sofa at home, and I'm saying, oh, hell, we can't afford that, we got to save this money, and the kids are wanting some shoes, and I say, well, we can't do that this month, we got to... Do I have any hope whatsoever of having any peace of mind? None whatsoever. If my basic instinct for sex gets out of kilter, if I begin to be the type of person that's going to have sex from here and here and here and here, and I can't be satisfied with what I've got at home, I'm immediately going to be doing things that I shouldn't be doing. I'm going to get out here and I'm going to go to playing around with one of these good-looking girls, and the first thing I'm going to have to do when I take her to the motel, I get out of the car, and the first thing I have to do is look around to see who sees me going in that motel. And if I go in that motel with her and I have sex with her, then I immediately have to be worried about what's my wife going to do when she finds out. Is she going to sue me for divorce? Is she going to take the children? I'm immediately going to have to be worried about what's this girl's husband going to do when he finds out. You know, is he going to beat the hell out of me? Is he going to shoot me? Is he going to kick her out? Or what is he going to do? Again, I rob myself of peace of mind if that basic instinct is out of kilter. If my basic instinct for what other people think of me, if my basic instinct to want to be a member of society and be liked and be respected gets out of kilter, it can cause all kinds of trouble. I may go out here and try to make $1 million, not so much because I'm afraid that I won't have enough to eat and I won't have shelter, but I may think that in order to have you like me and respect me and tell me how smart I am, that I'm going to have to accumulate all this land and all this property and all this money and drive these big, fine, fancy cars, and I drive myself completely out of my mind trying to gather up the material things which I think I need to have in order for you to respect me, and it robs me of peace of mind completely. Bill goes to very great detail in step 4 to tell us about the three basic instincts of life. And then he says that all emotional problems that we have can be traced back to one of these three basic instincts of life. Now, really, this is what we're looking for. If I'm resentful toward another human being, that human being has threatened one of my basic instincts. He's either threatened my security, my prestige, or my sex life. And if I'm mad at him, I'm robbed of peace of mind. So I make a searching and fearless moral inventory. And I put down here all these people that I'm mad at. What did they do to make me mad, and which basic instinct was threatened? I put down every fear that I have. And I put down by the side of it why I have it, and which basic instinct was threatened. Then I carefully review my past, and where my conduct has hurt another human being, I put that name down. And at the side of it, I put down what I did,
And then at the side of that, I put down which basic instinct caused me to do this. You see, my basic instincts are so strong that they can cause me to do things that I really don't want to do. You know, as a boy growing up, I can so easily remember that there was a word that you never did call another guy if you didn't want to fight. And that word was son of a bitch. I can remember a guy calling me a son of a bitch, and here I'm a little short guy, and I never was very strong, and I never was very tough. But he would call me that word in front of a group of people. And I didn't want this group of people to think that I was a coward. So in order to gain their respect and keep their respect, it was necessary for me to get up and try to knock him down because he called me an SOB. I really didn't want to because I knew what the results would be. I knew he'd beat the hell out of me, but I still had to do it. I know as an adult living in society today that I really shouldn't be having sex outside of my home. That my sex life should be with my wife. Sometimes my basic instincts for sex can get so far out of kilter that I begin to want to do something with some other women too. And I know it's wrong, but the instinct can become so strong that I may go ahead and do it anyhow. My basic instincts are strong enough that it causes me to do things which are against the laws of society, and they're also strong enough that they cause me to do things that are against God's laws itself. I happen to believe that every human being is born with a built-in conscience. I think basically deep down inside that we all know the difference between right and wrong. If I go out here and I go to fooling around with these other women, maybe my wife don't catch me. And maybe her husband don't catch me. Now, I'm scared to death they're going to. That alone has robbed me of peace of mind. But that maybe they don't catch me doing it. But even if I'm not caught, and even if they don't retaliate and cause further suffering and pain for me, I'm eaten up with guilt. Because I know that I'm doing something that I shouldn't be doing. If my basic instinct for security is so strong that it makes me steal from you and take money out of your pocket, maybe you'll never find out I stole it, and maybe you'll never retaliate. I'm scared to death you're going to, and that robs me of peace of mind. But even if you don't catch me, I'm eaten up with guilt, because I know the difference between right and wrong. Remember that Silkworth tells us that we have got to find peace of mind. We've got to get rid of this restlessness and irritability and discontent, or we always go back and seek the sense of ease and comfort which comes at once by taking a few drinks. Now, before I can get rid of the things that rob me of peace of mind, I must find out what they are. As Joe says, I must identify these things before I can do anything about them. And step four tells me exactly how to identify the things that are robbing me of peace of mind.
I guess it's about time for a break. But Charlie said, we know we've got many, many things that go on in our emotional lives that makes us uncomfortable. And I think it comes from these three basic instincts. We've got a lot of other things. We have jealousy and greed and guilt. And to me, I think that guilt to me is fear of the past. And I had a lot of dread, which is fear of the future. I had a lot of jealousy. And I think we can take these basic instincts and as we become professionals at mixing these things, and of course, we make all sorts of hideous colors out of these three basic patterns. Every other thing is painted out of these three basics. And I told them this gives us, we're going to work on the basics. See, I could be jealous of Charlie because of the jacket he has on. And it hurts my security because I get a little fear that he's getting ahead of me. He has something that I doesn't have. And so, you know, I resent him. It's a little resentment, probably is the base of jealousy. And then I have a little fear that he's getting ahead of me. And then jealousy also contains, he's punctured my little ego, my little image. So jealousy is contained in all three of these things. And jealousy is made up of a combination. And I have a lot of this. Of course, quite naturally, if I wanted to really get mad at Charlie, I'd take out the jacket and I'd put in a woman. And the jealousy would go up. And the only thing I've added was six. So you see, this is the way that we make ourselves uncomfortable. And this great book, this great step forward, shows us that to not to chase all these things, but learn the basics. It teaches us our basic instincts. And it teaches us in great detail of looking and examining these things. And this is what step forward is all about. When we're ready for a break,
yeah.
We'll stop and have coffee break. At this point, I might ask a question. How many of you own a 12 and 12?
Hey, that's good. That's good.
I know I fooled with this section of the big book on step four for a long time, and I just couldn't hardly understand what he was talking about here when he'd talk about self-esteem and pride and prestige and etc. And so finally I did get a hold of a copy of the 12 and 12 and went in and started studying it. And this was, I think, the breakthrough for me to begin to understand character defects and to begin to understand how these character defects control my life. And when I once learned that they come from the three basic instincts, then I had identified what my real problem is, why I'm always resentful, why I'm so fearful, and why do I keep on wanting to do things that I know I shouldn't be doing. And in the 12 and 12, in the area of 4, 5, 6, and 7, it goes deeper into it than the big book does, and it talks about the seven deadly sins. That I don't particularly like the word sins. Again, you know, I'm agnostic, and I still can't get rid of all that, and when you say the word sin, it kind of turns me off. But 12 and 12 says the seven deadly character sins, or seven deadly sins. I refer to them usually as the seven major character defects or personality defects or whatever you want to call them. But it tells me that every emotional problem that I have stems from one of the three basic instincts of life. And it tells me the seven major character defects that I have, and they are in all human beings to one degree or another, is pride, greed, lust, anger, gluttony, envy, and sloth. And it tells me that all seven of these character defects stem from one of the three basic instincts. And again, as an intellectual alcoholic, and I know you're not going to write these down, we don't have the time, but as an intellectual alcoholic, I had to go back to the dictionary again. Words I don't understand don't do me any good at all. And if I read a word in the big book of the 12 and 12, and I don't know what it means, if I don't go find out what it means, I might as well have not read it because it hadn't conveyed any thought or idea to me at all. So I went to the dictionary and I looked up these seven things. And pride, according to the dictionary, is usually attempting to impress others or building our own self-image, an excessive belief or disbelief in one's own worth. You know, we're filled with this pride. We're always trying to impress other people. That's a natural instinct. We're always trying to build up our own self-image, trying to make ourselves appear as good or better than other people. And many of us throughout our lifetime have always felt that we didn't quite measure up, that we were always on the outside looking in. And I think this is one of the reasons that I enjoyed drinking that old booze so much. When I drank that old booze, man, I didn't have any of that stuff of being afraid of other people, or I wasn't afraid I'd make a mistake. I wasn't afraid I'd stumble and fall on the dance floor. Pride is one of the major character defects that practically all human beings have, and we alcoholics seem to have it to an excessive degree. Greed. Greed is an insatiable desire to possess things beyond our own needs. And if I become a very greedy person, and I start trying to accumulate all these material things, there's no way in the world that I can have peace of mind. Lust. Lust is a desire to desire something to the excess, usually associated with sexual desires. Now, we can lust after many things, but normally it's associated with sexual desires, and it's desiring something to the excess. Anger. Anger is a feeling of displeasure because of supposed mistreatment, usually showing itself in a desire to fight back. Gluttony. Gluttony is indulging in anything to the excess,
usually associated with food. Envy. Envy is jealousy of another's possessions, unhappy because you can't have the same thing. Sloth. Sloth is simply laziness. I love it in the 12 and 12 when it says, procrastination is nothing more than a five-syllable word for sloth. Now, I look at my life today, and I search my life today, and any time that I become one of these seven things, any time that I become angry, any time that I become resentful, any time that I become fearful or jealous or envious, I search myself to find out why. And I find always that one of the three basic instincts have been threatened. And in step four, what we are really attempting to do is to find out how these things rob us of peace of mind. To find out how the resentments rob us of peace of mind and what causes those resentments. To find out how fears rob us of peace of mind and what causes those fears. To find out how the different character defects that I have cause me to be restless and irritable and discontented. And if I've taken step four and I've taken it thoroughly and I've taken it completely to the best of my ability, I'm going to be able to look at these things and I'm going to be able to say, well, here, this resentment that I have toward this guy over here was caused by jealousy. It was caused by greed. It was caused by lust. It was caused by anger. It was caused by fear. If I look at this thing real closely, I'm going to be able to see where this fear here is caused from my pride. And if I carefully review my past and see where my conduct hurt others, I'm going to be able to see, well, yeah, greed caused me to steal that guy's money. Lust caused me to do this. And I can begin to see the things that block me from carrying out the decision that I made in step three. I can begin to identify the things that I need to start working on. I can begin to identify the things that I need to start getting rid of if I want to have peace of mind. Now, it's impossible for the human mind to think of more than one thing at a time. You know, this taking an inventory in your mind, you can only look at one thing at a time. And if I'm taking an inventory in my mind and where I'm thinking about that one particular person that I hurt, I can't see all the others that I hurt. I can only see that one. If I'm thinking of that resentment against that one person, that's the only thing I can see in my mind at that time, and I can't see the other resentments. But if I will put these on paper, for the first time in my life, I've been able to see me. And you know, when I came to AA, I thought I was a pretty good fellow. I thought I just drank a little too much whiskey. I didn't steal except when I absolutely had to. I didn't lie unless it was absolutely necessary, and I thought that I was a pretty nice guy. But when I once put it on paper and got it all down and got all these resentments and all these fears and all these wrongs on a piece of paper, and I looked at it and I thought, my God, is this really me? You see, honesty is mentioned three times in the beginning of how it works. Step four is the first time in our life that we're going to be honest with ourselves. Always before, anything that Charlie did that wasn't right, Charlie hid it in the back of his mind and never looked at it. Never did try to find out what caused it. Never did try to find out anything about it at all. Simply hid it away. And in step four, this was my first attempt to really look at me and find out, why am I resentful? Why am I fearful? Why do I keep on hurting people when I don't even want to hurt them? And unless I can find out why, I don't know what to work on. You know, it doesn't do any good to say anger is my problem. I've got to find out what causes anger. It doesn't do any good for me to say that stealing is my problem. I've got to find out why I steal. It doesn't do any good for me to say that sex is my problem. I've got to find out why I want to keep on doing them damn things. Because even if I don't go do them and still want to do them, that robs me of peace of mind. And Silkworth tells me without peace of mind, I've had it. I'll go back and look for the sense of ease and comfort which comes by taking a few drinks.
Next, we're going to turn over to another chapter, Into Actions. Into Actions, we find, we'll begin with step 5. We found 3 and 4, our first steps that the book mentioned and how it works. Into Action is contained on the first page, the 5th step. And you can see how, having made a personal inventory, what shall we do? And he ties in the other steps. And he shows you how precisionally these inner steps in the lock. As we have discovered the nature of our problem for the first time in our lives, that we see ourselves, our character defects and our shortcomings, we see the things that have been blocking our growth. Then the next step to recovery is to bring these things